I'm Jasmine.
And I'm Greta, and welcome to another episode of Uncharted Maritime Tales, a podcast for maritime archaeology enthusiasts. This has been created for our Fathoming the Future project, made possible thanks to the National Lottery Heritage Fund.
Today, we're also joined by our fellow project officer, Eero.
Hi, everyone. Very nice to be here.
Eero is also involved in our Fathoming the Future project.
And is often our linguist consultant, including the Greek word Triskeles, which I've probably said wrong, which features in our Empress Queen Artifact of the Month video. And that's about a panel from the Empress Queen wreck, which had a symbol on it, which is on the flags for Sicily and the Isle of Man, I think.
Yes, it was very fascinating seeing the symbol on the panel for the first time at the Shipwreck Center. It made me wonder what the meaning of it was, because the first connection I made was with the Sicilian flag, but I thought maybe there was more about it, more to it. So it was very interesting discovering more about it and what it meant while Greta and I researched it.
In this episode, though, we're going to be covering a vital part of maritime archaeology methodology, geoarchaeology.
Indeed we are. Now, I'll be honest, when I started an interest in archaeology many years ago, I didn't even think that geosciences could actually be used to better our understanding of archaeological sites and human relationships. But it's amazing what it can tell us. So geosciences, for anyone who's probably thinking, what on earth? That's actually a really terrible pun, because it is that. It's earth sciences. It's things like sediments, soils, fauna. And our director, Gary Momba, he's actually going to go into that in a little bit more detail in a moment. But am I right in thinking, Eero, that the prefix geo comes from a Greek word, as many words do, actually?
Yes, you're absolutely right. The word is formed by the combination of geo and archaeology, so geo and archaeologia. So geo comes from ge, which in Greek means earth.
That makes sense, because geoarchaeology is the understanding of the earth's formation. And looking at that, you can give some context to the man-made archaeology as well. So you don't just have the pot now which someone used, you now have the environment where it's being used as well.
And to talk about this, we have a segment from Kristen, who works with us as a senior archaeologist.
So I'm here now with Kristen in our Queen's Terrace office in Southampton. Kristen is a maritime archaeologist and offshore development manager, so she uses geoarchaeology quite a lot on a day-to-day basis. So Kristen, thanks so much for joining me here. Just going into geoarchaeology, it's often described as being a technique that uses earth sciences to answer archaeological questions, but what exactly does that mean?
So archaeology, by definition, is the artifacts that people have used in past times, but geoarchaeology focuses on the landscape they lived in, for example. So that's one way of it, looking at really large landscapes and understanding where there's higher potential, because we know people need to live close to sources of fresh water, for example, rivers and things like that. So when you understand and start understanding and mapping the landscape, you can also start understanding and kind of being a model for where people are more likely to have been using that landscape. Geoarchaeology can be landscape, but it can also be looking into what's within the soils and the deposits. So looking at pollen, for example. We know pollen, people are familiar with it because they're often sensitive to the pollen travelling through the air. But that pollen gets deposited within the soil, and then that geology preserves it. So by looking at those samples, we can look at what trees and plants lived at a certain time. We can also look at insects and plant remains as well. We know pollen travels, other things stay within a local area, so then we can pinpoint and say, okay, so this was an area full of fern, for example, at a certain time, and that's what then we expect a certain type of animals to be utilizing those resources. And when we have animals, we also have people in the area. So geoarchaeology is quite broad, but it's using the environment, the geology, and what's within the soils to really understand archaeological questions and answer them.
So going into more benefits of geoarchaeology, is there anything else it can do to help us understand the past? Is it mostly about landscape and environment, or are there other things it can tell us?
So sediment, soils and deposits, they can really be understood kind of like layers of a very fancy tiered cake. So the archaeology has been deposited, like the sponge or the icing or the jam, within that. So when we look at not only when it was deposited, so not how the cake was baked, really old stuff at the bottom, we got newer stuff at the top. It's not always that simple because you got rivers cutting through older deposits, for example. You got things forming at different times as a response to changes in the environment. Mm-hmm. So when you understand what the landscape was like, you start to understand what were people like.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use that for dating as well. And again, with the plants, with animals, all that is kind of preserved within those sediments. So you can look in a broad scale, okay, here was a river, but then go down to the very small, okay, here was an insect of a certain type.
Right.
And especially with beetles, we know they are very receptive to environmental and climate change. So a certain type of beetle would only be live at a certain time, so that could be used for dating. Certain animals as well have evolved in ways that we can really pinpoint a date if we have nothing else to look at.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. I also love your cake analogy. I love the idea of like the icing being the topsoil. It's a new way to look at it. It's really good. Are there any, on the flip side of that though, are there any areas where geoarchaeology isn't as informative? Are there any grey areas where it might not be as helpful?
In terms of geoarchaeology, we don't always, we can't always pinpoint it to archaeology and humans, so the study of past humans. We talk about geology, we talk about deposits, we talk about landscapes. So it's useful, but what I think we always have to be careful with is when we do these big, large studies of landscape, that we don't just repeat what a geologist would say, that we really bring it back to the understanding of humans. But what does that say about archaeology? What does it say about the people that live there?
Mm-hmm.
And if you then collect a core, a vibrocore or a borehole, and different techniques, boreholes are much deeper, vibrocores are shallower in general, you can get the answer, yes, we dated, we can look at the pollen, we can look at insects, we can look at the plants. But again, have we actually done archaeology or are we doing geology? Mm-hmm. And I think that's important to bring it really back to have humans interacted with this environment.
I remember reading that Historic England described geoarchaeology as helping to understand site formation processes. But what exactly is that and how does geoarchaeology help with that understanding?
So the site formation is, if we go back to that cake, is how were those layers built up? Uh-huh. Like, when did you put the Smarties inside, in a way? And how? So kind of the movements, how did the soil end up where it is now? Was it moved there by water? Was it moved there by wind? Where do we have those rivers or valleys and seas? Where do we have the freshwater resource? And again, bring it back to where would people have lived?
Mm-hmm.
And also animals, because we know that food is obviously a very important aspect of life, to stay alive. So people do travel and move where there is freshwater and where there's food. Animals travel to freshwater and food as well, so we have that. And often in geoarchaeology, you do find a lot of remains of microfauna, is the small things, so plants and insects and beetles and things like that. But then we have macrofauna. Mm-hmm. As well, the big things, so antlers from Irish elk, which is a kind of big version of elk. We got woolly mammoths and things, and those are often found in deposits that date back to an ice age, where it's something that's found before the archaeology. It's found often in quarries and things on land, but also in the deposits that wash in from the seas. And we have a couple of beaches in Norfolk, especially, where you can walk along the beach and you can actually find remains from animals just laying on the beach. They're fossilized. Wow. You can find teeth, you can find antlers, fossilized, and they are older than Mesolithic. They are can be up to 800,000 years, which is close to Haysborough, one of the oldest sites in the UK.
Wow.
There, and those that evidence mostly comes from animal remains rather than humans.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I just love the idea you can walk down a beach and then just find something that's insanely old and just, yeah, brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Kristen, for talking with me. That's been, the bake-off analogy is it's really going to stay with me. That's fantastic.
Good, thank you.
I really like how Kristen stressed the connection between environmental sciences and archaeology, but she also kind of brought it back to the human aspect. That was really interesting to me.
Yeah, actually, and I also really liked how she used the cake analogy as well. That really made it quite clear to me. But also what she said about how insects, which only lived at certain times, have been preserved and can actually help with dating a site. That was really interesting.
Yeah, it really does help to fill in the gaps if you don't have much man-made archaeology at all. So, for example, we use geoarchaeology quite a lot in places like Boulder Cliff, where we really don't have the same level of man-made artifacts as, say, like a First World War shipwreck. So for those of you who aren't familiar with the site already, Boulder Cliff is a submerged Mesolithic landscape which now lies 100 metres underwater off the coast of the Isle of Wight. It is actually made up of several smaller sites which have been dated to around 6000 BC, and it's produced loads of work flint, timber, and even some string, which is really remarkable. But in order to actually really understand the site, we do rely on geoarchaeology to paint a picture of that environment that these Mesolithic people would have been living in.
True, and I was able to catch our director, Gary Mumba, and get him to speak a bit more on Boldner and what the geoarchaeology can tell us. So joining me here is Gary from the Maritime Archaeology Trust, the director. Welcome back, Gary. Thank you for coming and joining us again.
Pleasure.
So again, just jumping in here with Boldner Cliff, we've been talking a little bit how geoarchaeology works as a discipline as a whole. But then focusing on Boldner, what can the geoarchaeology tell us about the site?
Yes, well, very pertinent, because the what's special about Boldner Cliff is that it was once a valley, and the sediment came in and filled the valley and covered the valley with this 7 metres of sediment, and it would have stayed there and been protected for many, many thousands and thousands of years. So why this is so special? What's happened is you've got a new channel that was formed that cut right through those sediments and formed a section. So we just sort of chopped it in half. It's like there was a sort of an old valley floor, like an old Victoria sponge, let's say, with the different layers in it. And now, with the formation of what was actually the solent, you've got the centre bit sort of chopped out the middle, and then you've got the edges on the sort of north and south. So Boulder Cliff, as I said, is on the south coast of the Solent, the north coast of the Isle of Wight, mm-hmm. and it's part of what was an old infilled system.
All right, because yeah, you mentioned the Solent there. I was going to ask you, how has this changed our minds about the local area, about Isle of Wight and Southampton as an area in general?
Well, in relation to the geoarchaeology, say what we've used the archaeology and the landscape to try and understand, obviously, the people, but also understand the morphology. So we've used some of the archaeology to help date the changes and show what changes were. We looked at changes in the environment, so we understand how the environment changed over 8,000 years ago. We can work out, and then we're looking at the archaeology within the sediments, and we can look at the sediments and we can see where the sediments actually came from. So some of them came from the north, some from the east, some of the west. Through time, this changed. So we can link the time with the archaeology and date it, and then we can see where the sediments came from to understand how the landscape changed. And what it's told us is that, you know, the mainland and Isle of Wight were pretty much connected through this period 8,000 years ago, but actually the connection stayed for another sort of 5,000 or 6,000 years. So it wasn't until about maybe 2,500-3,000 years ago that we had the final severance of the Isle of Wight from the mainland, as it means in Britain, from the mainland. And that's a lot to do with just reading the sediments, where they came from, and understanding when that final full inundation of marine sediments happened is in that sort of geoarchaeological record.
Okay, well, brilliant. Thank you very much, Gary, for joining me and teaching us a bit more about Boulder Cliff.
That's okay. It's been a pleasure, Greta.
Gary mentioned a bit of geoarchaeology there, and I think studying the changes in the landscape of an area is very interesting, because we can understand how the area has changed over time. And it's very fascinating to be able to recreate the Mesolithic landscape and to imagine the type of activities taking place there before it was submerged.
Yeah, and I also love that he mentions that we can tell where the sediments have come from and how that can actually tell us when the Isle of Wight split from the mainland. It's just so mad that so many years later, we can still learn so much from the Solent.
So you can read more about Boulder Cliff on our website, and also head to our YouTube channel to see a piece of string from the site that is thousands of years old.
Now, it's not just the UK where geoarchaeology is utilised. In fact, the methods are used all around the world. And we now have a segment from Crystal on how techniques such as geoarchaeology can inform us about the Mediterranean as well. Crystal is an Onifrost Associate Professor of Maritime Archaeology at the University of Southampton, specialising in ancient Mediterranean seafaring,
geospatial data and mapping, and maritime cultural heritage. So Iro and I are with Crystal now. Crystal, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Greta and Iro. Thank you for inviting me to this podcast.
It's interesting because when I was at Southampton Uni, I remember doing the module on Mediterranean seafaring. And I know there's different methods that we use to understand how seafarers lived. You have all these things like ship's cargo. But thinking about it through the lens of geoarchaeology, is there a particular Mediterranean site where opinion was influenced by something like sediment analysis?
So, yeah, I mean, definitely. When we're talking about geoarchaeology, when we're talking about sediment analysis, and this goes hand in hand with any sort of maritime coastal archaeological investigation in the Mediterranean, because of the nature of just Mediterranean kind of history and environment and geography. And there's a lot of sites actually that have, you know, our opinions and what we know about them have changed because of geoarchaeological and sediment analysis. One site in particular, the site that we're currently working at, is Tyre. So it's ancient Sur, which was a, you know, a Bronze Age, then an Iron Age Phoenician harbor, and later on a Roman and Hellenistic site. So it's quite a, you know, it's a full maritime cultural landscape site. It's amazing. It used to be an island, and now it's actually connected to land due to when Alexander the Great conquered Tyre, he built a causeway to connect the island to land. And so this is where we're be going and doing some underwater investigation, and we've been doing coring and sediment analysis and all of that, and marine geophysics at the site, because it's a very complex site. So you really cannot understand where the ancient harbors were, because there's one that was in the north side of the island and one in the south. So we don't really know where the southern harbor is. So to try and understand where that southern harbor is, we had to rely obviously on coring, on geoarchaeological analysis, on marine geophysics. So we've done bathymetric survey, and there's loads of teams, actually international teams, that work at the site. We're just one of many other teams, and we work hand in hand with the Department of Antiquities there as well. But really kind of understanding the history of the site, you cannot try and start understanding the ancient, you know, landscape of Tyre without doing some geoarchaeological analysis, because, you know, it was an island and now it's connected to land. So how do you get your head around it? We need to understand landforms. We need to understand how that landscape has changed. And there's so many things that go in it. You know, we're talking about sea level change. We're talking about tectonic activity. We're talking about, you know, sedimentation during because of the changing environment, that it was an island and now it's connected to land. So the underwater environment is acting differently. So there's a lot of things that we need to try and get our heads around and study, so that we pick out where those ancient activities were taking place. Where was the southern harbor of ancient Tyre during, you know, various points at time? Because it might have changed actual location due to the environment as well. Yeah. So Tyre is one of those sites that, yeah, is, you know, doing geoarchaeological analysis have really kind of changed what we know of it.
So geoarchaeology is also helping you see, it's really fascinating because it's helping you see how it changed through time, not just from how it started and how it is nowadays, but also, as you said, is a multi-layered, a multi-period site. So that's going to help you see how it changed through time as well.
Yeah, exactly. So there's been a series of cores that were taken early on by Christophe Morange and Nick Mariner, and we've been doing more coring with Gilles Brocard. But basically what this is showing us is that, you know, you get a core, you get the, you know, the layers of the different sediments and so on, and then you can date them to different periods of time, and then you just try and connect the different cores, the different dates, to see where that landscape was. And sometimes you get just, it's very difficult to actually rebuild the whole landscape, because you're not going to get a date from one core that is exactly the same from the other core, that is exactly the same from the other core, to know where that landscape was at that point in time. But it will give us indications like whether that was a brackish environment, whether it was likely to be a harbor basin, whether it was, you know, a sand environment, so it was likely to be a beach at, you know, a different point in time. And then by just picking those bits together, putting them together, you get a bit of a better picture of where, how that landscape changed over time.
It's like a puzzle that you don't have the final image of. You have to figure it out as you go.
Yeah, you will never have the final image. It would be amazing if we could have a final image, just be like, this is how it was.
Does that inform how you work then? Do you understand that first and then decide where to go from there?
Yes, absolutely. So what we've done is that, first of all, we've done a marine geophysical survey, a wider marine geophysical survey. So we've done swath bathymetry and size scan sonar, and this was around the wider landscape, because with marine geophysics, it's very difficult to try and get into the shallow bits. And it's the shallow bits that we're really, is where, you know, that activity was happening and where we want to investigate the potential of the harbour. So we've done a marine bathymetric survey that tells us a bit about the nature of the wider underwater environment. And what we've done next is that we've done a series of new cores around areas that around places where it will likely give us an indication of how the land connects to the underwater environment. Because we have underwater features already that are submerged, but we also don't understand why they are submerged. You know, is it tectonic activity? Is it, you know, we that connection between the underwater remains and the remains on land, we need to establish. So by coring on land and by coring in shallow bits, then we're able to try and connect these two together and see where is actually the best place. That this is what we're doing now. We're trying to establish where is the best place for us to go and start that actual underwater excavation, a bit of looking at those features that are in that shallow environment to establish how they connect to the land remains. So by doing that, we're trying to establish what we're gonna do next. And this is really the kind of benefit as well of all that geoarchaeological analysis and geophysical analysis, is that sometimes it's the first step to help us understand the wider environment and then hone into what we need to specifically, or identify what we need to do in terms of next steps at the site.
I think what's really interesting that you said is that you're not just focusing on one point on the map. You're analyzing the whole area around the place where you are eventually going to dig. And the analysis is actually kind of indicating and dictating, leading you the way to where to start exploring.
Yes, absolutely. And this, you know, we have to do that because it's such a complex and it's a big site, you know. And there's a lot of archaeological work that's been happening there from, you know, 1920s, from starting from Podbar and Onufros. And, you know, there's a lot of work, that's archaeological work, that's been focused on the site. So we need to understand that wider landscape, wider archaeology, what is happening, so that we try and understand where we sit within that. You know, we cannot just go and be like, where is the southern harbour of Tyre? We're just going to decide and go and dig somewhere. It doesn't work that way, because we can keep digging in different places and not actually find anything.
Yeah. Even though you said it was an island, it's not actually in an island.
Yeah.
In an archaeological sense.
Because it's not isolated, is it?
Well, it's very interesting. It's even trying to understand where the kind of boundary of the island was at different points as well in time. Because obviously due to sea level, it was an island. And then sea level was rising. And then that island was becoming, you know, smaller in various forms. And then, you know, it was connected to. So understanding that boundary, where we draw the line of the island, is very difficult.
Is there a way that this kind of data can also tell us about coastal change and how that may have impacted maritime activities and people's everyday lives in general?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look, I mean, I'll talk about, obviously, I'm originally from Lebanon, so I'm very familiar with our maritime archaeology around the coast. And when it comes to really understanding coastal archaeology, there's no way that you can try and map what happened in the past without looking at, you know, without looking at, you know, how that landscape has changed, both in terms of the sediment, in terms of sea level rise, in terms of, you know, understanding the indicators of where the sea level was at different points in time. So we have a lot of features sometimes around the coast that are rock cut features. And there were features that were potentially part of anchorages, of harbors, of just salt marches, of people just cutting these features to and use it for their settlements. So understanding these features and understanding why they are, for instance, on the coast, why they are submerged, what is their function and all of it, it's all about looking at that landscape. Because, and especially in the Mediterranean, really, it's not just about sea level rise, sea level change, it's actually tectonic activity is things that can happen very differently on two very close by beaches. So the north and south of Lebanon, for instance, you have subsidence in the south and uplift in the north. And you're like, well, it's a tiny coastline. It's not a massive coastline. So, you know, you cannot just, and that's why it's difficult actually reconstructing ancient Mediterranean landscapes, because you can't just take a sea level curve as we see them and apply them to the Mediterranean, to a Mediterranean coastline. You need to look at what is happening locally and regionally within that, on that coast.
Sometimes I think people just think they can just overimpose maps with different coastlines and say, oh, this is how it changed. But as you said, it's really important to go to, like, locally to a specific area, because then that is really interesting to see how that impacted, as we said, like, everyday life. Because if the coast that was once there is not there anymore, then your life and everyday activities need to be reconsidered and changed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I mean, so, like, for instance, in Lebanon, there's the Honor Frost Foundation team, the Lebanon team, and they've been doing a lot of surveys along that coastline. And there's other people who get grants as well, and archaeologists, for instance, Nicolas Carayon, he's a geoarchaeologist. And he's been looking at the rivers, because it's very interesting, actually. So it's not just about, you know, coastal features and harbors and so on. It's in fact, looking at that, you know, how that coastal environment connects to inland through rivers as well. And those rivers and river mouths probably were used as anchorages and potential harbors at different points, because they provided that, you know, fresh water, they provided environments that, you know, were better for people to live around. So, but understanding how those rivers have changed, you know, from, let's say, Bronze Age, Iron Age, you know, Phoenician period to Roman period to today, is massive. Well, especially when we're talking about, you know, coastal development, about urbanization, it's changed a lot how our coasts look today. And to, you know, if we can just erase it and go, yeah, it's a difficult task. That's why we have to rely on every single tool that we have, on, you know, interdisciplinary research, on geoarchaeology, on geophysics, on the sciences, on marine sciences, because it is people coming together to try and figure out, remap that landscape.
Wow, that is amazing. Yeah, I had to use so many different aspects of archaeology, because I think I mentioned this earlier. I always just used to think archaeology was just, you find something, an artifact that belonged to a person, and that's its limits. But it's really wonderful, the more I learn about it, to see how, yeah, sciences, geophysics, and things like geospatial data can all come and paint more, contextualize really the archaeology that we're finding in the ground as well. I was actually going to ask a bit about geospatial data. So can you actually use that with geoarchaeology to almost like a mock-up of a past environment as well?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we can do much without geospatial sort of mapping and geospatial data, because it is so fundamental to our work today, in terms of, just because everything that we do is spatial, isn't it?
That's actually, I should have specified, for anyone who may not know, what would you define as geospatial data?
Oof.
Sorry, just to summarize that in 2 minutes.
Yep. Geospatial data, so basically is data, is any sort of data, is basically a digital representation of is digital information. So it's digital information that have that spatial component to it. It means that we know where it is in the world, and it can be anything. It can be a point data, it can be, you know, this is a site and this is where it is in the world. It can be a line that represents a route or represents a river. It can be a model, let's say an elevation model or a bathymetric model. So what is the depth of that seabed? So all of that, if we know where they are in the world, it means that they are geospatial data. So we can put them on a map, we can know where they are, and it's actually knowing where these things are is important. So it's how we survey, how we grab that geospatial, how we grab those coordinates. So, you know, geospatial data is kind of equivalent to things, elements in the world that have coordinates associated to them. Geographic information systems are software that enables us to work with geospatial data, to integrate geospatial data into them, and to be able to store that geospatial data, to be able to manipulate it, to integrate it, to do some analysis. So we can run a lot of, you know, a geospatial analysis on the information that we have, and to be able to represent it, generate a map, GIS, Geographical Information System, are what enables us to really work with that geospatial data that we are capturing through our survey methods, that we are capturing through geoarchaeological analysis and through excavation. So being able to add it into a software, whatever we decide to use, being able to interrogate it, be able to kind of, you know, integrate the layers that relate to each other and reconstruct that environment digitally is very fundamental. So, you know, I teach GIS at the university. I always work with Geographical Information System. For me, it's a given. You know, I can't do archaeology without that, without applying geospatial methods to the questions, to the research, to post-processing, to dissemination, to representing that ancient landscape.
Because it's basically a repository where you can put different types of data and then, as you said, see it visually and see how sometimes connections that you didn't see necessarily when you had different pieces of paper with the different analysis results, but all of that can be brought together and see how it connects and intertwines on a GIS.
Yes, absolutely. That is the joys of working with a GIS.
Well, I might leave it there, actually. I feel we could chat about this all day, but we probably should wrap it up there. Thank you so much to Crystal for joining us for this. And it's been absolutely wonderful to chat to you.
Thank you very much, Crystal.
Thank you both. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much to Crystal Asafadi for that segment. It was lovely to hear how geoarchaeology is such an integral part to our understanding of past human existence. It was also brilliant to learn a bit more about geospatial data and how that's pivotal to understanding basically every aspect of archaeology. We spoke a bit about GIS there, Geographic Information System, which is a software that archaeologists use quite a lot to understand spatial data. And that leads me quite nicely onto our next segment with Steph Blanksheen, who specialises in digital archaeology. So Steph is an archaeologist and a research fellow at the University of Southampton. Steph also has a PhD and her interests are predominantly maritime and landscape archaeology and prehistory. So I'm here with Steph and Iro now. Steph, thank you so much for joining us. We've talked previously with Crystal about software such as GIS, but how can digital archaeology as a whole help to understand past human activities?
So digital archaeology, digital methods are essentially just another tool that archaeologists use to investigate the past. It's not unlike using a trowel or if you work underwater, like myself, using a dredge. So we look at it as just another tool to explore the past. And what it does is it enables us to address questions that we wouldn't be able to otherwise. So for instance, we could conduct large-scale analyses. We can move beyond looking at a single site or a single artifact, and we can start looking at multiple sites and even larger regions. And this is important because it helps archaeologists form a more cohesive interpretation by analyzing the relationship between archaeological sites and even between archaeology and environment. And that's really, really important for us to be able to do.
So you basically go from the things you find, the analysis you've done, and create a larger picture and put everything together.
Yeah, exactly. So what we can do in working in tools like GIS, so Geographic Information Systems, there's this wide range of geospatial analyses that we can conduct. The possibilities are endless, especially with emerging technologies and new software that's constantly being developed. So we could analyze, for instance, the intervisibility between sites. So now we can look at a much broader picture between different communities, between different settlements. We could, for instance, look at the proximity of sites or finds to the coast. So really, it's about just having these really interesting, really exploratory questions, being able to bring that all into the digital space, onto a computer, and then, analyze it and work with it in interesting ways.
I think what's really interesting about what you're saying is that you're using digital tools, but you're kind of bringing it back to the human level, because then the intervisibility is going to tell us more about how the various sites were interacting with each other. And that then means that we know how the communities were interacting with each other.
Yeah, exactly. for instance, my doctoral thesis, my research was looking at the Neolithic in the Western Isles of Scotland. And typically, you might work on a single settlement or maybe a single material such as pottery. And what I was able to do was actually look at the entire archipelago. And this is a over 200 kilometer long archipelago island chain. And we were, so what I was looking at was this idea of an archipelago-wide identity. And the only way that that was formed, what we're seeing in the archaeological record from the pottery styles and the monuments that were being constructed, the only way that was able to be formed was through connectivity, through movement. So we really then have to bring that sort of large-scale analysis down to the human level to think about what was the nature of that movement, how were people actually moving through the landscape, through the seaways, and we can build this much richer picture by sort of putting ourselves in that space as well and seeing from their perspective. Walking through some of these landscapes, you realize it is so challenging. Like, how were they doing this? And then you look at the seas, it takes 2 hours to take a modern ferry across to these islands. And people were doing this 6,000 years ago in crazy little boats. So yeah, it brings it down to that personal level and it allows you to connect, especially through that space, through that environment.
Oh, wow. It's wonderful that you get that appreciation, like you say, going, oh, they did these in these tiny boats, and yet we sit on a ferry and complain about, oh, it's taken forever to get over there. It's just absolutely amazing. Well, we've also spoken a little bit on this episode about cores and how they help us understand sea levels. But how do cores then enable us to understand things like and lake levels, and how can we reconstruct lake levels?
So it's a really good question. It's also a really tricky one. So with sea levels, we know that in general, eustatic or global sea levels have been rising throughout the Holocene, or basically since the last ice age. And of course, there's a lot of variability in this. The actual nature of change will be quite localized, and it's based on a number of small-scale factors, such as geology and topography, but it's also based on a number of larger scale factors, such as isostatic adjustment, or basically the up and down movement of continents. But once you incorporate these factors, you begin to get a sense of these longer term trends in sea levels. With lake levels, it's a lot more complicated. They will, of course, be affected by many of the same factors as sea levels, but lakes are also highly susceptible to changes in climate. And that becomes really, really tricky when you want to then reconstruct those lake levels through time. So, of course, there are cyclical seasonal fluctuations. For instance, a lot of lakes will have lower water levels in the winter and higher in the summer, or whichever period you get more rain. So you'll have that sort of seasonal fluctuation, but then you also have these completely sporadic, unpredictable fluctuations, such as a period of drought, as we've seen over the past couple of summers, or a period of heavy rain, as we've seen quite recently. And these will cause the levels to fluctuate at such a minute scale, at such a small temporality, that being able to unravel that from a core is actually really, really tricky. So for instance, we've been working on a site on an island in a lake for many years. And over time, we go back at about the same time every year in July, and lake levels are broadly the same. So we've never really thought otherwise. Now, this past summer, we're out. We were out in April, and we came back in July. Between April and July, lake levels had risen nearly 40 centimeters. We'd never seen them that high. Then, in a 24-hour period of really heavy rain, they rose another 40 centimeters. We come back out to site the next day and the entire island is flooded. Our terrestrial trenches are just completely flooded. There was no way that we could have predicted that, which means that then if you're looking like we are nearly 6,000 years in the past, how could you possibly reconstruct that as well? So it becomes really challenging. But what I think perhaps lake cores tell you the most is how difficult it is to reconstruct lake levels. The cores that we've been taking, I would say what they have shown us is that actually it's not really necessary to reconstruct lake levels. that in fact what we're seeing is that the levels today are broadly similar to what they were 6,000 years ago.
Oh, wow. That is not the answer I thought you would.
Well, because I'm guessing the cores just give you a broad picture, but they're not going to give you what was happening on a daily basis or even monthly basis. And so that's when experiencing the landscape, going in person on site, and then experiencing these changes, then you can actually better interpret the cores. Because as you said, then you realize maybe reconstructing lake levels is not as relevant in this case, because you experience the landscape and you understand that the information you get from the cores might not be what you're looking for in this instance.
Yeah, exactly. I should say now that that was a bit dismissive, but we have taken lots and lots of cores around the lake, and a lot of the deeper cores that we took actually turned out to be really tricky, because what we found when we dated some of the materials in the core is we actually had older dates on top of earlier dates. So there's been a lot of activity, perhaps slumping, you know, there's been some sort of dynamic events within this lake that are then making things even more complicated. But we have taken a number of cores much closer to the shore and especially on the island itself. And that's when we then start to get really useful information when we compare it to the archaeology. Because now we're kind of matching what we see with what the core is showing us. So, for instance, we have this structure. It's a submerged structure around an island. We've taken a series of cores. The question is, were lake levels the same, broadly the same, or was this completely dry land, or was it a marshy area? Now, the cores can tell us that, especially the cores that we've taken on the island, because we see this really distinct contact layer between the archaeology and the lake bed clays. So that tells us it wasn't a marshy environment because you wouldn't have such a distinct difference between the two. And it obviously was water. It wasn't dry land because we see the archaeology sitting on the lake bed. So yeah, it does tell you things. And there's a lot more obviously that can be extracted from the cores. So obviously I said we've dated some of the organics that we found in the cores, and we can look at pollen, for instance, and think about what the landscape around the lake was like. And we can look at diatoms and sedimentary DNA, so we can understand what the ecosystem in the lake was like. But again, none of those things are really, really getting us to actual lake levels. So it is very tricky.
It's very interesting though. So we've been talking a bit about cores as a method of collecting geoarchaeological data, so taking samples out of the ground, which is quite invasive. How does that data compare to, say, the benefits of non-invasive data?
Yeah, so, well, archaeology, as most of us know, is inherently destructive. So if you take a core, if you do small-scale sampling, it will be less destructive than, say, excavation. But once you extract that environmental archive, that's it. You can't put that back in place. And you now have to then conserve that archive, record it, and do your best with it. Non-invasive methods, non-intrusive methods, are basically a way to see through the ground without actually having to dig into it. So in its broadest sense, non-invasive methods are known as remote sensing. Essentially seeing or sensing through a surface remotely without having to touch it. That is a main advantage of these methods, because you don't have to disturb the site to find out what's there, and you can actually use it in advance of any more invasive methods by, you know, finding the best place to take your cores or to excavate. And that's been used quite extensively in archaeology, with much success, I would say.
So looking at things like geophysical data as well, I know that's such a broad topic to go into in such a small segment of time, but how what's the advantages of that data rather than invasive?
Yeah, so one of the things that we can do is we can, again, going back to the benefits of digital methodologies in general, you can cover a much larger area than you could if you were taking a core, if you're doing these, you know, sort of small scale test pits, anything like that. So you're covering a much larger area, you're getting a more comprehensive picture of the site. And So for instance, we've been working on a site for many years, the same island. We started excavating underwater in 2021, and it was only then that we realized that the submerged deposits are much larger than what we had imagined. We had taken cores before, as I've said, but we didn't know where to best place the cores. So we guessed and we said, okay, well, let's go just a few meters out from the island. We have archaeology there. Okay, great. Now let's excavate where we took the core. Oh, wait, it's bigger. It's bigger. It keeps going. It keeps going. Oh, okay. This is interesting. So the cores obviously weren't able to tell us that because we didn't know the best place to take them. What we decided then was we needed to go and do some geophysics. So we've done different sorts of mapping of the loch bed, but in this case, we wanted to trial ground penetrating radar. In this instance, water penetrating radar, which is essentially the same method. You just are in a boat rather than on the land pushing a trolley. So it's quite fun. And it's really, really interesting because that then allows you to see through the surface in a way that we couldn't possibly with excavating or with cores.
It's really good to see how geoarchaeology fits in with other techniques used as well. Often I think it's quite easy to think of these as isolated subdisciplines or technologies and just think, well, I'm a geoarchaeologist, that's what I do. But it's really fascinating to learn how, like you say, they can all complement each other and really help each other out. Well, thank you so much, Steph, for joining us. This has been really, really insightful, and it has been absolutely wonderful to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been great.
Thanks, Steph.
Well, I think that might be all we have time for today, but thank you so much for joining us for another episode.
Thank you also to our guests, Kristen, Gary, Steph and Crystal, for their various insights on geoarchaeology. This has been Uncharted Maritime Tales.
See you next time.